BCFM 93.2. Your award-winning radio station.
Welcome back to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time, with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. So, why was News International still paying Andy Coulson when he was supposed to be David Cameron's press secretary? And what was this fella who looks increasingly like a potential criminal mastermind doing in Downing Street? The phone hacking story exposing the culture of lies at News International, Scotland Yard and in Downing Street relentlessly rumbles on. But we go back 25 years this week to 1986 and the Wapping dispute to hear just how much the British media has changed, how the power of the owners and the editors has grown over the writers and journalists since then. And as the 9/11 10th anniversary approaches in a couple of weeks' time, we ask, is it possible to plant a bomb and blame it on your enemy? We hear that it certainly is, from a man who did just that. But he got caught. A neo-fascist jailed for life in Italy for the murder of three policemen. And health workers will be out on the streets of Kingswood and Clifton Down tomorrow, canvassing your support. Why, then, are they targeting Lib Dems and giving up their days off to stop the privatisation of the NHS? But first, it's been a momentous week in Tripoli, particularly with what began midnight on Saturday night, that is Operation Mermaid Dawn, with dozens of NATO rebel sleeper cells activating within Tripoli itself. Now, Martin Summers is joining me. Martin, were you surprised? We actually were discussing the whole of the Middle East and focusing on Libya on a show last week, and then to hear sort of a day or so afterwards, suddenly everything erupting in Tripoli.
Well, I mean, we knew the fighting was going on. It was a question of what was going on. And obviously, from a distance, it's very difficult to know what's going on, partly because it's just difficult to find out, and partly because both sides are lying. I mean, that's part of modern warfare, is you tell fibs about what's going on.
The Psy War, is that what you mean by lying? Because they're
yes, I mean, you know...
Psychological warfare.
I mean, it seems, for example, that the rebels and NATO have been exaggerating their success inside Tripoli in order to encourage Gaddafi loyalists to put down their weapons.
Is this about morale, really?
Exactly, it's part of morale. As General Petraeus said about Afghanistan, he said it's all about perceptions, and so an awful lot of what you're doing is trying to manage the perceptions of the world at large and the people that you're trying to fight. Britain did it in World War II. Famously, we landed, you know, the Allies landed in Normandy while the Germans were convinced that it was the thrust was going to come through Calais. And of course, that's what you do in wars. You tell fibs in order to try and get your objectives.
Now, what about the human rights angle to this? Because the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, it was signed in the aftermath of World War II by one NATO, seemed to be violating some of these articles from the Universal Declarations of Human Rights. First, they send in military with explosives in violation of the UN Security Council resolution. Then NATO assassinated Colonel Gaddafi's son and one of his sons and three grandchildren on the day after the royal wedding here. Then they blew up parts of the Libyan water system. The latest violation was attempting to take out Libya's national television network by bombing their satellite stations. So what about the human rights side of all
this?
Well,
I mean, this is partly the whole argument of the end justifies the means. Now, the question is the end justifiable? Let's face it, these rebels may turn out to be extremely unfortunate for the citizens of Libya. We just don't know. Maybe they are Democrats and freedom fighters and freedom lovers, as NATO maintains. Maybe they are not. We don't know. But, of course, the methods you use also become the methods that everybody else will use. So when the Russians are trying to suppress Chechnya or Dagestan or whatever, will they be justified in bombing TV stations, in killing rebels, killing their enemies' children? And the answer with the Russians will be, well, you do it, so we do it. This is why many countries oppose the invasion of Iraq. It wasn't because they like Saddam Hussein. It's because you're setting a precedent here. It's why the Russians and many others oppose, for example, the recognition of Kosovo, because they recognise that, you know, many countries have got separatists, and maybe they'll all be encouraged. Well, all these separatists, well, will you recognise Kosovo? Recognise us. It's not just the initial case of Libya. It's the question of if you use these methods, they become the methods that everybody else feels is justified. And that's the issue. And even if the end were justifiable, which is questionable, because of course the motives of the West in Libya are very much being questioned around the world, are you really that interested in humanitarianism? You don't seem to be that interested in Bahrain, for example. And of course, if I was a Bahraini, or even in Egypt where the military are still in charge, it's quite obvious that armed struggle is the way forward. Armed struggle is justified. The Libyan rebels have proved that you pick up the guns, you start killing the police, you start killing the army, that's the way forward. That's what the IRA used to believe, that's what the Libyan rebels believe, that's what rebels in Bahrain might believe, or rebels elsewhere might begin to believe. And of course, in Bahrain, you've got the US 6th Fleet there. It's not the 6th Fleet, I've forgotten which one it is. They're allies of the British. So of course, if we're talking about armed struggle, the Bahraini boys might decide it's time to kill some British people and the British Prime Minister's children, for example, because you've set the precedent. Now, this is what people have got to realise. War is not a game. Well, it's not everybody being happy about what's happened in Libya. I am basically hopeful that something good will come out of all the chaos. But let's not pretend that the last 6 months of bloodshed have been a good thing. War is always a bad thing.
Well, the Russians and the Chinese have made it clear that they won't be signing up to any kind of similar UN resolution at the Security Council again, haven't they?
Basically, that's right. If you abuse the Security Council, as the West has done in this case, then in other cases coming forward, you won't get the same kind of level of cooperation, will you? And I think people don't think about the unintended consequences. We've got a general Middle East war, not just a war in Libya. We've got renewed fighting between Israel and Palestine, we've got the uprising in Syria, we've got loads of stuff going on in Yemen. Everybody in Yemen can realise, well, the only way to go forward now is to pick up a gun and fight. That's the way forward, isn't it? The Libyan rebels have shown the way. It's war all the way. And that goes for pro-Western regimes as well. So let's have a civil war in Saudi Arabia and get rid of that regime. Let's hang the people in charge. Let's put them all up against a wall, because that's the way it's done, isn't it? That's the Libyan rebels have shown the way. Let's do it in Saudi Arabia. Let's do it in Bahrain. Let's do it in Yemen. Let's put all these people up against a wall and it bloody revolution all the way. Get the guillotines out. Now, the West doesn't really think like that. It's only their favoured rebels which are allowed to do that kind of thing. If you're on the, you see, they're called rebels in Libya, but in Afghanistan and Iraq, they're called insurgents. Do you see the way language is abused there? The Libyan rebels are rebels, but the people fighting against us in Iraq and Afghanistan are insurgents. They see themselves as rebels, they see themselves as freedom fighters. And the fact is that once you've started the ball rolling for war as the answer rather than negotiations as the answer, which we could have had in April, a proper negotiation between the existing regime and the rebels, the West vetoed that, it's war all the way, isn't it? Including Bahrain.
What about, before we get completely off the subject of the sort of psychological warfare and using the media, psy wars, there is also the occasion this week where the BBC showed some footage from Al Jazeera, which was supposed to, it said it live on the screen, this is BBC World, I think, was the station, yeah. Where it actually said live on the screen from Libya, and it was talked about by the presenters as a demonstration going on live in Libya from Libyan people who were very pleased to see the final, at least, I mean, it may not be final now, but what they thought at the time was the overthrow of Gaddafi, whereas actually the scenes were stock footage, which was actually shot in India.
Yes, and I think what's been going on...
This is the BBC picking this
BBC
up from Al Jazeera.
From Al Jazeera, and Al Jazeera, of course, is a mouthpiece for the government of Qatar, who are protagonists in the Libyan conflict. So what they say has got to be taken with a pinch of salt, because they're one of the protagonists. Basically, modern warfare relies an awful lot on perception management. So this whole uprising in Tripoli was talked up by the Western media because of manipulation by security services, and they over-egged it because they wanted the Libyan government forces to think that they were losing. So they lie that they are losing. Britain did similar things at the end of World War II. We broadcast into Germany saying Hitler's defeated, put down your weapons, even though he wasn't defeated and it was still going on. It's a trick of the trade. But people who are listening and watching on television or picking up information have got to be aware that when a war's going on, the first casualty is truth. Well, that's what goes on in every war.
One of the other things, this isn't the first time that Al Jazeera, the footage has been proven to be false.
It's not the first time.
Because right at the very start, back in March, when we were told these horrific scenes of Gaddafi using his own air force to bomb his own people, that's also, there's question marks over that.
There is the Russian general staff gave a press conference where they said, look, we've got satellites watching everything that goes on in the world, just as you have. There was no use of air power at all. And as I've stressed week by week as this crisis has developed, Operation Southern Mistral 2011, if people do an internet search, they will find it. It's been on the French Air Force website since last November, and it was a war game of exactly what has happened. Now, some people may say that the deed justifies the act, and that if we get a positive regime in Libya, it's all justified. But it's increasingly looking, when the history books are written, they will probably confirm that this uprising was not a peaceful uprising from the very beginning. It was an armed uprising by armed groups supported and backed by NATO. Now, that may be justifiable, but it's not what we've been told. We were told that peaceful demonstrators were shot down and then fighting started. Now, I'm quite sure that the historians will say, no, actually, fighting started straight away and it was encouraged by NATO. Now, you may say, oh good, we've got rid of Gaddafi. Well, I say, oh good, we've got rid of the King of Saudi Arabia. Let's put him up against a wall and shoot him, because, as I said earlier, it's bloody revolution all the way now, no holds barred.
Well, I don't know about that, but Gaddafi, certainly one of the things I was looking at was how he was actually making preparations to nationalise the entire oil industry in Libya before all this started towards the end of the last year. And it really does give the lie to the idea that he was a complete dictator of the country, because he had an elected assembly which actually told him that he couldn't nationalise the oil industry.
Yeah, but can I come back on this? I am not here to defend Gaddafi's regime. I think that the Libyan people have got their own views about that. Some of them will have found the regime positive. We've had people speaking on our show who were positive about the regime. We've had others, as we heard earlier, who are not positive. I presume that there is a spread of opinions in Libya, as in most countries. Many people here don't support David Cameron. Some people do. That's normal in most countries. But a problem with civil war as a means of resolving that is it can go on and on and on and on. What about the people who are not happy with the new regime? They have been told that the only way to make yourself heard is to pick up a gun and fight. And we've seen it in Iraq and Afghanistan, that the people we supposedly defeated 10 years ago and 5 years ago are still fighting. And maybe in Libya we're going to find exactly the same. The obvious thing to do if you're a Gaddafi loyalist is blow up the oil wells, attack the oil pipelines like FARC does in Colombia, like the resistance does in Iraq, so nobody gets any money. If we're not having it, you're not having it. It's the obvious thing to do, and if you've got enough political support, you can do it. You can just basically deny the oil to whoever wants it.
Now, I know payments were made by French company Total and also by the British company BP to the Gaddafi regime towards the end of last year.
Yes, they were all very much in favour of him until they weren't.
Well, these payments were actually to do with the extradition of Megrahi for the Lockerbie killing. Yeah. But the company Exxon, the American company that has oil on interests in Libya, actually refused to pay towards the end of last year. The other aspect to all of this, never mind the oil and the oil companies' interests in Libya, Libya itself apparently was one of the only countries in the world that actually had no debt.
It was a wealthy, developing country, and it had, in a generation, come from being a poor place to being a wealthy place. It only got 6 million people. Even if Gaddafi was a kleptomaniac, he managed to provide plenty of services to the ordinary people. Now, as Don Foster said in the first hour, just because you're being given free healthcare doesn't mean you live under a free regime. And it may be that people have legitimately decided they don't want to live under that regime. But what makes me extremely worried is that we have been told a load of lies about everything that's happened from start to finish. Basically, this has been a coup d'etat engineered by NATO with weaponry from the very beginning. The bloodshed is on NATO's hands. So basically, all the people that have died are as a result of NATO planning. Now, that may be justified. You could say, well, we've got rid of Gaddafi and we've now got a lovely free Libya. But let's see what their economic policy is. Is the IMF going to come in there and tell them what to do? Are they going to have their own policy? I suspect not. I suspect that what we're going to look at is the West is going to tell them what to do and they're going to rebel again, because that's the only thing that people will do in the end if they don't get what they want. And don't forget, these people are armed. We could see a civil war within the rebel alliance. It's quite likely. It's happened in Iraq, it's happened in Afghanistan. Why won't it happen?
It's already happened, actually. Factions within the alliance.
The guy who was in charge, forgotten his name, Jibril, I think it was assassinated by other groups within the rebel alliance. Now, basically, we are being given a euphoric story by our media, which is basically, it's not serious. Serious reporting of war says people are dying, both sides are fighting, horrible things are being done by both sides. Most wars, I was an aid worker in Bosnia, most wars, everybody's in the wrong. There's very little wars where you can find, oh, they've got the white hats, they've got the black hats. That's not the way of it in the real world.
Bristol Community FM 93.2. Your voice, your choice.
Now, health workers will be out on the streets of Kingswood and Clifton Down tomorrow afternoon canvassing your support. Why are they giving up their days off, targeting Lib Dems particularly, and they're trying to stop the privatisation of the NHS?
I'm Karen Cole. I'm the Unite the Union officer covering the health sector in the Bristol area. This weekend, we've got members that actually work in the health sector in Kingswood Shopping Centre in the morning, handing out leaflets, asking people to sign the petition in support of saving our NHS. And in the afternoon, we are at the Clifton Down Shopping Centre at the bottom of White Ladies Road. So we're asking people to come along and support our campaign to save the NHS and to campaign against the Health and Social Care Bill and sign our petition. In the Bristol area, we have got in the region of 2,000 members. Across the whole of the country, we've got 100,000 members in the sectors. So we've got quite a significant number of members in the health sector that we're very concerned about.
But the government will say that what they're trying to do is actually to streamline the health service. And what's the problem with allowing many more people to provide the health service itself, so long as the government is still controlling the way the money's spent?
First of all, this is the biggest reorganisation of the NHS since it was introduced in 1945. The health sector is under great pressure at the moment. They've got to make 20 billion cuts. As you rightly said, the Health and Social Care Bill is going to introduce competition, set up GP groups that will control the budget and deciding who is going to provide the services. There are lots of private sector health companies in the background just waiting to swoop in and take the work that is going to provide them with the most profit, leaving what remains of our NHS with work that doesn't provide a profit. Also in the bill, all hospitals are going to become foundation trusts. Now, we've got some of them already, and that means they become businesses. They control their own income, they can invest in the stock market. There's people in charge of these hospitals that really don't care about the patients, and they're totally out of touch with normal working people, with pensioners who won't be able to afford to pay for private care, and they need to actually listen to the community they serve rather than putting out diktats about how they wish the health sector to be run. At the moment, foundation trusts have a cap on the number of private patients they can take on. That's going to be removed. So on top of they've got to make all these cuts, they're getting less money, they will also be under pressure to make more money, which means they'll take on more private patients, and then the waiting lists are going to grow. And people that are waiting for things like hip and knee operations in a lot of pain may be forced to go private. And of course, there's people that won't be able to afford it. So not only are the private sector health companies waiting to swoop in, also the insurance companies who provide health insurance are just sitting there waiting to pick up a lot of business. But also, when we're talking about our members and jobs, the trusts will be making people redundant, so they can't provide such a good service. They've got less people there, and that's going to impact on the service delivery to patients.
Now, this is all in the name of efficiency. And that's one of the reasons why they're going to be getting rid of staff, ultimately, is because the health service, as it is inefficient.
Well, I totally disagree with that. We've got over 100,000 really hard-working members. If you look at the customer satisfaction with the health sector, it's the best that it's ever been. We see no reason for this reorganisation at all. Andrew Lansley was planning this for 5 years, and this reorganisation was announced weeks after the Condem government came into power. It wasn't in their manifesto. In fact, David Cameron said there'd be no top-down reorganisation of the NHS. They lied. The Conservatives have been planning this for years, and it's not about making cuts. It's all about dogma. They do not believe in our wonderful NHS. They want it to be privatised. This is privatisation by the back door, and it's having a huge impact on our members in terms of the cuts already, because they've not had a pay rise for 2 years. They're attacking their pensions, and a lot of our members went to work in the NHS because they want to work in the NHS. They believe in what they do. They want to provide good patient care. And if this bill goes through, they could end up working for a private sector company. And private sector companies focus on profit and not on patient care. They will attack our terms and conditions in terms of our members. And I think we shouldn't be making money out of people that are ill and people that need care. And when we see the private sector coming in, you've only got to look recently in Winterbourne with a care home that was privatised. Look what happened there and the abuse of patients that went on there. Look what happened with Southern Cross going bankrupt. I think people need to fight for our NHS. If people don't get out there and fight for it, we are in danger of losing it. First of all, if they want to get involved in the Unite the Union campaign, if they go onto the Unite website, which is www.unitetheunion.org, and click on the Save Our NHS campaign, they'll find all details on there, what they can do. People should be writing to their MPs, petitioning, particularly our Liberal Democrat MPs, who have gone into a coalition with a Conservative government and are going against all Lib Dem beliefs. So people need to get active, get involved in our campaign, write to the chief executives of your local health trust, tell your doctor. I mean, a lot of doctors in this country are not happy with the Health and Social Care Bill, and get the message out that we love our NHS and we want to save it.
That was Karen Cole, and she's from Unite the Union, speaking to me earlier this week, and they will be out, and she and her colleagues will be out on the streets of Kingswood and Clifton Down tomorrow afternoon, where we are reliably informed it will not be raining quite as much as it is right now. It'll be sunny, hopefully, all afternoon tomorrow.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol, and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Well, as the 10th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks on America is coming up soon, the resulting war on terror and various wars liberating people by regime change and also liberating oil for Western companies continues. But very few people know that during the 1970s and 1980s, many of the terror attacks from groups like the Red Brigades in Italy, the Baader-Meinhof in Germany, Action Directe in Belgium, were in fact secretly ordered by NATO intelligence from their Brussels headquarters. These attacks were carried out by neo-fascist groups, but blamed on the far left and on the Russians. Though hundreds of innocent Europeans died at NATO's hands, our Western media has studiously avoided the possibility that NATO stands to gain from spectacular attacks on the West, like 9/11 and 7/7, with the resulting increase in military budgets. But surely NATO couldn't tell such a big lie? Well, back in 1992, the BBC transmitted three documentaries by US filmmaker Alan Frankovich. They exposed NATO, the CIA, and Britain's Foreign Intelligence Service, MI6's top secret plans to blow up European civilians and blame it on the Russians. The programme was never repeated. In the documentary, Frankovich interviewed one of three secret soldiers serving a life term for the murder of several policemen, which the authorities tried to blame on the Italian left. So here is an extract from the documentary, and also speaking after that is neo-fascist, who's doing a life term, Vincenzo Vinciguerra.
For 40 years, secret terrorist organizations, many trained by Western intelligence agencies, have manipulated the political control of European sovereign states by a campaign of terror and murder. Originally part of a secret network, these groups changed from being defenders of state security into attackers of the established political order. Until 2 years ago, that secret network was generally known by the single word, Gladio. Gladio,
così come è stata definita.
Gladio, as it is defined nowadays, forms part of what I have always referred to as parallel structures. That is an invisible army that is not poised for battle against a hypothetical invader, but rather one meant to be used internally against what the military have always called the fifth column of the USSR, the Communist Party, and the extreme left. That's Vincenzo Vinciguerra there speaking, and me doing a little sort of translation from the BBC Two Time Watch programme, Operation Gladio, screened in 1992. Now, Martin Summers, this was quite a significant programme. What do you think that is the most interesting thing about it? Because it was really telling us something that many people, particularly the military, didn't really want people to hear.
Well, it's not just one TV programme, although it was a very good programme, as you know, Tony. Also, there were parliamentary inquiries in Belgium, Italy and Switzerland, which all concluded that the programme was essentially correct. The Swiss academic Daniel Ganser, who we've had on this programme, wrote a very influential book, or very important book, called NATO's Secret Armies. Basically, it's not a conspiracy theory to say that NATO blew up Boulogne railway station in 1980, killing 83 people, that the Dortmund Beer Festival was blown up, killing 16-odd people, and the Brabant massacres took place in Belgium in the 1980s, which were basically attacks on supermarkets, again, killing civilians. That's not conspiracy theory. It's historical fact that NATO secret intelligence organised those terrorist attacks for political ends. And, now, of course, the significance is, does that mean that a lot of what's going on now and passed off as terrorist attacks by our Islamist enemies are in fact being manipulated by our own intelligence services? There's got to be a big question mark there.
Because what Vinciguerra actually says there is that actually in Italy there was actually an invisible army that was actually none of the parliamentarians knew about, only the Secret Service.
Indeed. I mean, basically people imagine, because that, you know, if they study politics to O level or GCSE or whatever, that, you know, we elect a government, the government's in power, they then tell the government machine what to do. In reality, you've got powerful vested interests who inhabit the government machine, and they basically drive the policy, and the politicians are pulled along in their wake. It was parliamentary inquiries which eventually uncovered this in Italy, in Belgium, and in Switzerland. And Andreotti, the former Prime Minister of Italy, was tried three times in relation to some of these events, and managed to escape each time. But frankly, the Western media does a very poor job of explaining the actual power structure to the ordinary folk. They're either peddling trivia, or they're peddling a very, very sanitised version of events to people. We're the good guys, we mean well, but occasionally we make mistakes. No, nobody has been punished, for example, for bombing of Boulogne railway station, which killed 80-odd people. That was a terrifically horrible attack. It killed lots of innocent people, but nobody's ever been punished because they're being protected. Still.
Now, we recently had these attacks in Norway from Anders Breivik, and he was also supposed to be, anyway, at least a neo-Nazi. Vincenzo Vinciguerra, which many people haven't heard of, he was. Do you think maybe that there is actually more to this, that this is the tip of the iceberg? There may be actually more of these neo-Nazis involved in terrorism?
In the Norwegian case, the question has to be, did he act alone? And if he didn't act alone, who did he act with? It's a perfectly legitimate question. Now, the Norwegian police at this stage are saying that he did act alone. Okay, maybe we trust the Norwegian police, maybe we don't. Because the question is, that it's quite clear that in previous attacks, for example, on Boulogne, not the ordinary police, but the secret police and the high-level police were involved in the commissioning of the attack. And far from investigating it, they are the perpetrators. Now, that's why you have to have independent police powers. That's why the police service of Northern Ireland, for example, has been set up, not the Royal Ulster Constabulary, and why we've got a peace process. Because the police should have primacy in investigating terrorist attacks, because one of the prime suspects in any terrorist attack anywhere is your own security services. You've got to rule them out as suspects to begin with, because they are always suspects.
Well, needless to say, you cannot get the Alan Frankovich documentary from 1992 on DVD. One place you can find it, though, is on the internet. And, in fact, it's available as three episodes altogether, which is a bit of a long watch, something like 2.5 hours, or else it's available on YouTube in little clips, little sections. But it's called Operation Gladio, BBC 1992 Time Watch programme.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Now, the phone hacking story, which we talked about earlier, exposing the culture of lies at News International, Scotland Yard and Downing Street, has been rumbling on. But now we go back 25 years to 1986 and the Wapping dispute. But first of all, Martin, what was the Wapping dispute?
It was a dispute between News International and its print unions. Rupert Murdoch basically overnight moved his operations from Fleet Street to a purpose-built factory at Wapping and sacked all of his existing employees, who were then laid siege to the plant for some months.
Now, what was your involvement? Because you've told me that you actually were there.
I was involved in the printers' support group. I was living in Oxford at the time, and we had a couple of printers who were living in Oxford, and we worked with them. We used to organise bus trips to Wapping to support the printers. We collected money for the families. We tried to give as much support as we could.
Why did you think it was an important cause then at the time?
Because, as we now see, Rupert Murdoch is a man who is not to be trusted with any power whatsoever. And we knew that then, but lots of other people have finally caught up.
Okay, so let's hear from former copy taker at the Evening Standard, the London Evening Standard. That's Mary Brodbin. And I asked her just how much the British media has changed. How has the power of the owners and editors grown over writers and journalists since 1986, when Rupert Murdoch moved production, as we just heard from Martin, of The Times and The Sun, from Fleet Street out to East London in Wapping to break the strength of the print unions?
My name is Mary Brodbin, and I was in SOGAT at the time. I worked on the Evening Standard on Fleet Street, and therefore, though I wasn't involved in News International, all print workers, journalists, copy takers, I was a copy taker at the time, wanted to rally to the support of those people who had been sacked overnight by Murdoch, because he wanted to create a new workplace outside of Fleet Street, and he didn't want to have to deal with unions. He wanted to break the strength of the union.
So how did the unions work beforehand in Fleet Street?
Well, we had a closed shop, which meant, actually for me, when I got my job, you didn't go to the Evening Standard or the Daily Express. You went to the SOGAT office and said, are there any jobs? And they said, yeah, and these are the jobs. And then you went from there. So it was all controlled by the union, which is great. And also, when you got there, the good thing was you would have chapel meetings, which is workplace meetings. And if you didn't attend three in a row, you got branched, and therefore you no longer had a job. Now, some people might think that's a bad thing. Some people might think the unions are too strong, but it made for a very healthy workforce. We all felt confident, we all felt secure, and we were able, when necessary, to take action or write the stories that should be written. And, for instance, the printers at one time, when the Sun newspaper, called the Miners, the Scum of the Earth, they blacked that issue, and it came out with a front page which was white. So, you know, we had a massive feel that we actually had a part to play in the paper, instead of now, where it's all bullying and lack of unions and all contract work and freelance work, where you've got no feeling that you can do anything without getting told, oh, well, by the way, we don't want you back here next week because you're only on freelance, so it doesn't matter. But then at that time, we felt we had a secure job, and we felt secure to do things and say things, which nowadays, of course, wouldn't get any headway at all. You'd lose your job.
But from a management point of view, how can they possibly manage a newspaper business if the union is deciding who is going to turn up for work that day?
Well, there was never any problem about people turning up for work.
I'm a manager. Surely should be able to manage their staff.
Well, they did. I mean, once you got the job, I had a manager. I worked in the copy-taking department, and we had a manager. His name was Mike Bishop, as it happens, and he managed the rotors, he managed the time off, and we had a good relationship, and that was fine. And he was in the union as well.
So what role did Murdoch play then, back in the 80s?
Well, I think what's happened, you see, instead of having journalists who actually were doing a good job of journalism, whereby you'd have on the Daily Mirror Paul Foote, the James Cameron, John Pilger, and a fantastic team at the Sunday Times, which was News International, of course, when they had an insight team where they'd investigate things like the thalidomide scandal and a whole number of things. Now we've just got celebrity tittle-tattle and rubbish, and the Sunday Times is now just a commodity sheet. You have the motoring section, which sells cars. We've got the style section, which sells beauty products. We've got the travel section, which sells holidays. You know, it's just a sort of almost an advertising medium, you know, with a bit of editorial thrown in here and there. And so therefore it's a whole different kettle of fish. You did feel that people were actually in those days being allowed to produce a paper which was more sort of investigating things and sort of producing something which was a bit more worthwhile than reading what Kate Moss had for, you know, for a honeymoon dinner.
So, Mr. Murdoch, do you think he's going to ever go to jail, or anyone's going to go to jail from News International for phone hacking?
Well, I think if the establishment are able to, they will try and prevent that at all costs. That's obvious. It just depends how strongly we can organise. There is a move afoot that we actually have a demonstration at Wapping at the end of the summer in September, where we'll get all those people who have a grievance against Murdoch, which is a hell of a lot of people when you come to think of it, all the people who have been sent to war on a lie, which he defended and actually helped propagandise, or, you know, all those people who were hacked, all those people who are lies are told about, all the racism, all the people who are on the receiving end of Murdoch's sort of vicious journalism, if you want to call it journalism anymore. If we can have a wonderful demonstration to Wapping and say, look, you know, it doesn't have to be like this, join the union and we'll make sure that, you know, you're not bullied, you don't have to work long hours for half the pay, wouldn't that be a wonderful result?
As someone who's seen the world before Rupert Murdoch, worked in the newspaper world before Rupert Murdoch turned up, what would you like to see done now in order to actually improve journalism, particularly print journalism in Britain?
I think it's a very simple thing, but very difficult at the same time, which is join the union. If we could have people who felt the strength of the union, that therefore they weren't going to be bullied or singled out or on contracts which last 3 months or a week sometimes, you know, if they felt they had a staff job where they were part of a workforce which had the union strength behind it, that would change things fundamentally, I think. You know, that would hark back to the good old days where you could actually say, we're not putting up with this shit, you know.
That was Mary Brodbin there speaking to me a couple of weeks ago in London. She was, at the time of the Wapping dispute in 1986, working as a copy taker in Fleet Street for the Evening Standard. Now, Martin, I wonder if you, because you actually were there in 1986, down at Wapping on occasions, can you just relate to some of the experience and tell us what it was like and what were you actually doing?
It was quite, basically, the people had been sacked laid siege to the plant on a rotor basis with their supporters, and particularly on Saturday nights, large numbers of people would come who supported the printers to try and stop the lorries which were taking the News of the World and so on out to be delivered the next day from leaving the print plant. And the Metropolitan Police basically bashed us out of the way every time and let these lorries come out. In fact, several pickets died, at least two pickets died run over by lorries, people who were not necessarily printers, who were just there as part of the protest. And I remember one of the final big protests where huge arc lights were shone into a crowd of about 12,000 people, and then suddenly we were all being beaten up by the police riot squad, and I was personally on another occasion dragged off and beaten up and taken into the police station, and I immediately said, the people who've arrested me, I want to charge them with assault. They didn't turn up to charge me with any offence because they knew that they were the offenders. They're the ones who'd beaten me up. I hadn't done anything. That was how it was. And if we look at the way in which the Metropolitan Police are now shown to have been working very closely with News International over the years, it all starts to make sense, doesn't it?
But it doesn't really make sense, though, does it, to have the union deciding who gets jobs and who doesn't? Surely that's the job of the employer.
There were issues about union power in Fleet Street, let's not pretend there were not. But on the other hand, if you sack the existing people completely and bring in a whole new workforce who've got no rights at all, is that justifiable? The answer is no. I mean, it was just after the miners' strike where there'd been the whole question about whether there should or should not have been a ballot. In my view, there should have been a ballot in the miners' strike. There was a ballot at Wapping. Everybody voted to strike, and on that basis, they were all sacked. Now, do we want to live in a country where if you vote to go on strike, you can be sacked? In many countries in the world, that's not on. If you vote to go on strike, you are protected. In Germany, for example, it's in the constitution. If you vote to go on strike legitimately and you are on strike, your job is protected by the constitution. Only in Britain do we have the rule that if you go on strike, you can be sacked. Now, I don't want to live in a country where that can happen. You should have to negotiate And that's what should have happened at Wapping. That's what should happen in a lot of situations. There should be genuine negotiation about change. Change has to happen. Don't forget that the hot metal presses, which the printers used to use, are history now. Journalists basically input their own copy. They don't need hot metal people. But you don't just throw people away like an old shoe. There was no redundancy paid to any of those people because they were dismissed for being on strike. So after years and years and years of working in Fleet Street and the esprit de corps and the camaraderie of it all, he's just thrown away like an old shoe at the end of it. Is that right? I don't think it is.
Well, many would say that Rupert Murdoch did try to negotiate with the print unions. It's just that they weren't listening. They actually felt arrogant over this whole situation of we decide who works.
No, because ultimately, basically, that's what all trade unionists aspire to, is being able to control who works in an industry or not. I mean, you can see the way it works is quite simple. If somebody's working on your job who's not a member of the union, then we refuse to work with them. That's perfect. I'm not going to work with somebody who's not a member of a union. And if they're not a member of the union, I'm not going to work with them because they're undermining my position. This is well understood through trade unionism over many, many years. And that's the bottom line. If somebody works while you're on strike, they are taking your livelihood. And you're absolutely entitled to say, I'm not working with those people. And that's. But unions have got to be strong enough to make that stick. And Wapping, they weren't.
So ultimately, what was... Because basically, the print unions lost, SOGAT and the print unions lost that battle at Wapping. What was the effect of...
Well, if you think Eddie Shah then said...
He was a proprietor of the Today newspaper.
Yeah, that's right. All the other proprietors then waded in behind Murdoch. Murdoch has played a pivotal role in industrial relations, not just in this country, across the world. A pivotal role in the corruption of governments. A pivotal role in the pushing of neoliberal warmongering in the United States of America. Fox News makes propaganda newsreel from Nazi Germany look positively balanced, but it's still there pumping lies out day in, day out, feeding people's minds rubbish. Now, that is not actually a legitimate role for media. Media should have to conform to certain standards of objectivity, otherwise they shouldn't be allowed to operate. But, of course, what's happened is the media have become an infotainment industry allied to a military-industrial warmongering complex. It's just totally unacceptable.
Is there any evidence, then, that some of these military companies actually have interests in the media? I know in the United States...
Of course, there's cross-ownership between the media moguls and groups like the Carlyle Group, which are big profiteers in the arms industry.
Now, so actually, former Prime Minister John Major was one of the directors of Carlyle Group after he left office.
Lots of politicians often are. What you've got is a complex developing between neoliberal business in the financial insurance and real estate sector. The media is very important at pushing all of these agendas, and the military-industrial complex. And democracy can go hang. And that is that is where we're at, folks. We're about to have a banking collapse. Not that you'll read about it in the Times. The Telegraph today was being quite honest about a banking collapse. There's going to be a banking collapse. Now, what the media should be telling people, there's going to be a banking collapse. What are we going to do about it? You won't be seeing that in any of News International's publications.
Never mind the press for a minute. What about the Treasury? Do you think they're prepared for a collapse?
No, they're not. And that will be cruelly exposed.
Thanks, Martin.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Now, hundreds of Irish travellers who were told to buy land or be moved on daily by the police are due to be evicted by Tory-run Basildon Council in Essex from the land they bought because the council's refused to give them planning permission. If it goes ahead, the eviction could be the biggest ever seen in Britain, and it's due possibly to start any time from about 10 days' time. It will arguably solve nothing, though, as the travellers have nowhere legal that they can go. Lib Dem peer Lord Avery spoke out this week about what he sees as a crazy law that needs to change.
The eviction at Dale Farm is just so stupid, I can't believe it's going to happen, because you've got 50 families who are living peacefully on the site who are going to be thrown on the roadside with the disruption that that involves in family life, the disruption to the children's education, use of police manpower on a large scale when the police are being cut. It doesn't make any sense at all.
Now, Dale Farm in Essex, that was Lord Avery, by the way, Lib Dem peer. Martin, it looks like this could be the biggest eviction ever seen in Britain.
Well, I think it's appalling, and I agree with Lord Avery. I mean, basically, these people have been living relatively peacefully for a long time on what's looking at this, what we've got in front of us here, what used to be a scrapyard. Why not leave well alone? Why go around stirring up hornets' nests?
Well, the problem is, of course, that the presence of this large gypsy encampment in Basildon, or on the outskirts of Basildon, as one of the big problems is it's really made put lots of people into negative equity and made the people who don't live on the farm, also but nearby, their house prices have gone through the floor.
Well, that's called the free market, isn't it? I don't know what they're complaining about. So prices can go down as well as up. No, actually, the problem is that people are obsessed with things like house prices.
But the travellers haven't got planning permission, Martin.
Well, that's an issue, but they've got to go somewhere. They're going to chuck them off here. They're going to return up somewhere else and make those people into negative equity. So how are you're just pushing the problem around, aren't you? It's like squeezing a balloon. Ultimately, you've got to try and find solutions for these things which are long-term. And people shouldn't be sitting there worrying about their house prices. Don't worry about your house prices. They're going through the floor. We're just mentioned the banking collapse. It's not the gypsies that are going to destroy your house prices, it's the bankers. They're going to smash your house prices. What are you going to do about that?
But this isn't really going to help those who live in the local area and simply, you know, what they see is basically this traveller community flaunting the law.
Are they flaunting the law?
Well, they are not allowed to stay there because they don't have planning permission for half of the site, which is about 200 families.
Well, the rules are the rules and everybody needs to abide by them. I don't know enough about this individual case, but I would point out that if you go around evicting people, they've got to go somewhere else. Where else are they going to go? Have you a plan for that? Because if you haven't, they're going to turn up on somebody else's doorstep, creating exactly the same problem. And then you'll have to go through the whole process again. Now, people need to take a step back and think, how do we resolve this?
Now, the bailiffs who are doing the eviction, Constance, have reportedly even been paid £2 million already in preparation for this eviction. And it looks as if the eviction itself could cost many millions of pounds. But ultimately, what are we going to get for that money?
Well, a potential civil conflict. What if the gypsies get shotguns and petrol bombs and take the Libyan rebel view that they're going to fight back?
Well, they're certainly prepared to die, some of them. That's what they've said.
Well, who knows? I'm just saying that these kind of tensions are inevitable as the economy goes down the drain. So we're going to find all sorts of people rubbing against all sorts of other people and all sorts of potential for conflict. And rather, there's going to be plenty of potential for conflict already. Think of the millions that were spent on the riots which weren't predicted last week. This is a riot which has been predicted and millions have already been spent on it. What if it turns into a riot and somebody dies, a police officer or a traveller or some passerby? Is that going to be a sensible solution to the problem? The answer is no.
So do you think that the people who camp gypsies and travellers like this should be able to flaunt the law of planning permission?
There should be a discussion about what planning permission implies in this particular case. I don't know.
Because the irony being, of course, that Basildon Council could award them planning permission.
Indeed, and save themselves a lot of bother. Now, what they're trying to do, it's a Conservative-led council, and what they're trying to do is we will clear them off here as long as you carry on voting Conservative, and we will protect your house prices. Let's push them over the border into Labour-run wherever. Now, this is the problem we've had with travelling people for many generations, and I've lived next to travellers' places. My sister used to live next to them. They're not necessarily very good neighbours to have. That's an issue. It needs to be addressed. Nobody should be running away from it.
But there are all sorts of people who are not travellers who can be bad neighbours.
Well, indeed, and also, you've got to ultimately be realistic about solutions. You can't wave a magic wand and make it all go away. It's like saying wave a magic wand and make the banking collapse go away. Wave a magic wand and make the war in the Middle East go away. Wave a magic wand and make these problems come out of my way. I live in the country and I don't want problems. Well, that's just silly. The real world is very small. And it's a very small place for all of us.
But ultimately, how do travelling people fit into the whole sort of economic system?
Well, at the margin, quite clearly. There are issues about, where travellers are breaking the law is there to be enforced. But also, there's got to be some give and take about this. If you're going to kick people off a site, they're going to go somewhere else. Where else are they going to go? Just as we're pointing out, they've all got their kids in local schools. Where are they going to go? Do we care about educating them? Do we care? Maybe if the kids are educated, they may grow up to change their lifestyle and go and do something else. But not if you put them back on the road. That won't change anything, will it?
Do you think there's an element of legitimising a kind of racism here?
Absolutely. Absolutely, and it's very, very dangerous. And of course, people who are legitimising this and think they're going to make political capital out of it, I've just got one word for them. It's Belfast 1969. And if you want to go down that road, that's where you'll end up. But you won't like it when you get there.
Bristol Community FM 93.2. Your voice, your choice.
Channel 4 political personality of 2007 and Parliament Square peace campaigner Brian Hoare died in June this year, but also sleeping out on the square night after night had been his friend, Barbara Tucker. Now, whereas when Hoare was arrested, it was national news, Barbara's arrest a fortnight ago has attracted not a line of mainstream press or broadcasting publicity, hardly even in London. Well, Barbara is suing the Metropolitan Police for theft of artwork taken by them from Brian Hoare's camp over the last few years, but she is not staying at Parliament Square now because of the arrest, and has now been jailed in Holloway Prison for several weeks. So, who is Barbara Tucker? Well, who better to tell us than her herself?
I've been brought up through a military family, military background. My father went off to war when he was young, and he said we went off to war, we thought it was going to be a wonderful adventure. We got there, we were terrified, and he told me the truth of his experiences in war. He was in the Second World War. And then when I was younger, I was in Gaza. I saw such injustice there, and I had young boys about the same age as me saying, tell the world we have no hope, and things have got a lot worse. So I think it is this, you go to where the source of the problems are, the government, and it is a case of saying enough is enough. And you say, I'll stand up and take responsibility. You know, we should have the confidence to stand up and say when something is wrong, we know what's wrong. You know, we should value human life. If you really value life, you value all human life, and you want justice for everyone. And we're not seeing that from this government at all, so we're saying to this government, enough is enough. We don't want an ever bigger government or ever bigger big business, really. But we're saying people have to take responsibility. If you want change, you have to do something about it. So we are actually doing something about it. And I've been inspired myself by all the beautiful people I've met from throughout the world, really, that come and visit us in Parliament Square. The truth is, the people do care for one another throughout the world, whatever you read in the press, trying to create conflict amongst people. The people from all around the world care for one another. But I say, like Brian, we care, but I think that people need to care enough in this country, because in this country you have the ability to change things.
That was Barbara Tucker there, speaking earlier this year on Edge Media TV, an interview with Brian Hoare too. Now, Martin, this protest at Parliament Square is particularly significant, isn't it? Because Brian had a kind of unique right to be there.
Yes, I mean, they passed retrospective legislation to try and prevent people doing what he was doing, but it couldn't apply to him because legislation can't be retrospective. But obviously they're trying to impose it on Bab Tucker.
And how significant do you think it is that she's actually from a military family herself?
Well, it's not surprising. People from military families and people who serve in the military are often the people who understand why war is wrong far better than the blowhards in the sticks who want to fight other people but they don't have anything to do with it themselves.
Now, there's been a bit of conflict over the actual sort of patch of land of Parliament Square, because there are other groups that are also interested in using it to do protests.
Well, yes, don't forget that in other parts of the world, for example, in the 1989 revolutions in Eastern Europe, people camped out outside the party offices and the parliament buildings to demand things were done, and that's part of their right. I mean, it may be inconvenient for the politicians and for whoever, but I'm afraid that's just part of the constitution, that people are allowed to protest if they like. And these rights to protest are being eroded in this country. If you think of the kettling of the students last November, that was basically designed to intimidate and make them feel that they should never demonstrate again. Putting people for 11 hours with no food, no water, no toiletries, that was in basically a message, don't demonstrate in the streets. Well, there's only one answer to that, and they gave it in South Africa, they gave it in Poland. We've got to give them the same answer. We are going out on the streets, whatever you do to us.
Now, the other thing, of course, with this is that Brian Hoare and Barbara Tucker were both very, very constantly repeating that the two things that they had the biggest problem was the world drugs industry, the drug sort of illegal trade in drugs, and also the illegal trade arms and weapons and weapons of war. Do you think they're right to focus on those two issues?
Yes, I mean, the two things are absolutely linked. The CIA involvement in the drugs trade is well, well documented. Colonel Oliver North was uncovered as doing major drug dealing in the 1980s by Senator Kerry's committee. There's loads of websites about this, CIA, CIADrugs.com being a good one, Narco News is another. the intelligence services, the financial services industry and the drugs industry are all of a piece. They always have been. The dirty money now is the dominant force in politics in our lives. And it's about time we had a serious discussion about what's really going on, because we've basically got a criminal ruling class. When I say a criminal ruling class, I mean they've all got Interpol files. Rupert Murdoch, I am sure, has an Interpol file.
But doesn't that mean that they're also very vulnerable?
Ultimately, yes. But we've got to have enforcement of the law. In Latin America, activists talk about what they call impunidad, impunity. The law is on the is written down, but the people, the powerful, never have to obey the law. They can get people killed and they get away with it. And this is the point. We've got to get to a point where the law is written down and it's also enforced. And this has been the root of the problem in Northern Ireland over many years, is that the law was basically being broken by the state, but the state was not being held accountable. Ultimately, that leads to revolution, like we've seen in Libya. And of course, revolution is not a holiday. It's not fun. As Mao Zedong long ago pointed out, revolution is not a Sunday afternoon tea party. It's an act of violence by which one class overthrows another. Now, I'm not particularly bigging up Mao Zedong, but I'm just pointing out that if people want to have all of these revolutions all over the world, revolutions are a bloody business.
Now, Channel 4 News political personality 2007. Yes, that's Brian Hoy, died in June. Former merchant seaman he was. And I interviewed Brian at a Stop the War demonstration in 2008, where he talked about the way that many of these senior military officers who had agreed to begin with to debate with him at the Oxford Union backed out.
Colonel Bob Andrews, the action man from Basra, he was going to come. He didn't turn up. He had business in the Middle East, apparently. Yeah, it's called genocide. That's what it's called. It's called bomb, burn, beggar your neighbour. That's what it's called. But he's just doing what he's told. And most of us do what we're told, don't we? And we march nice and peacefully between the crowd barriers, like we're supposed to do. We're penned in. Do you know the way to change things? No, it's not with a revolution. It's not with force, not with violence. It's with peace. That's what pisses them off about me, you know. Absolute. Are you an absolute pacifist, Brian? Oh. Can you be a partial pacifist? Are you against all war? Well, check out war. Check out what it's for. War's for making money. That's what war's for. Check out the innocents who die in war. And it's the most innocent who do most of the dying. Have you noticed that? The babes, the infants, the old people, the weak, the sick, the poor. These are the people who do the big dying in war. The ones in uniform. And they've been taught to protect themselves, haven't they? To keep their head down. Well, some of them have. Some of them haven't had a chance to, have they? Their heads blown off before they've had a chance to learn.
That was Brian Hall there, who was Channel 4 News' Political Personality of the Year 2007. Well, that's all for this week. Coming up next, the Sky News at 7 o'clock. Thanks very much to our guest in the first hour, who was Don Foster, MP Lib Dem for Bath, and also to Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Next week, comedian Mark Thomas comes to town. Just go to thisweek.org.uk and click on the link to our archives, or else bcfm.org.uk. This is Tony Gosling wishing you a lovely weekend, and see you next week.